You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Labor, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's our Louisiana song. It's our favorite melody. It's our Louisiana song. Hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
Hey, we have a really interesting program today, and you're going to hear stories of the type in the Oak that you've never heard before, because it deals with old New Orleans and different cultures and cemeteries and just all and musicians. There's so much richness to what you're about to hear. It really deals with the soul of New Orleans and with souls. So with me is Warren Bell.
Hello, Errol.
Hi. Some of you have been around New Orleans may have remembered that he used to be the news anchor at WDSU Channel 6. He's retired from that, but he has not lost that big news anchor voice. You can still hear it. It still resounds.
Some things come with the DNA, I guess.
Yeah. And so you can still tell, boy, this guy used to be a news anchor. All right, Warren, you have just produced and moderated and pretty much put together a show called Buried History, Finding Our Past. It debuted on WYS Channel 12. It's shown several times. And we're going to tell people how they can hear it. But there's so much to it. First of all, tell us about your family, at least tracing back to your great-great-great-grandfather.
Well, I guess I'll tell you the origin story of this story, which has everything to do with the origin story of my father's lineage that we knew so little about, Errol, like so many families who are never really aware of anything past perhaps their grandparents.
Yeah.
And in a lot of cases these days, I'm surprised at people who don't even know where their own grandparents might be buried or what they did. But 3 years ago, my mother, who was still alive, said, I need to talk to you. She said, you know, your dad and I already picked our place long ago. Your dad's waiting on me there because my father died in 2006. This was 2019 at the end. We had just lost another of the Bell siblings. Two of my brothers younger than me have now passed away. And she said, you have not made any final plans yourself. We already have our plans. In case you didn't realize it, your grandmother left your father her family tomb, and it's been sitting for years. My grandmother made sure we kept the paperwork and the custody of the tomb.
Did you know about that when she told you?
I remembered my grandmother being buried there in 1985, Errol. And my grandmother was so special to me, she kind of spoiled me. My mom was raising seven children. So it was my grandmother who first told me how to stir the condensed milk into the coffee. And when it reaches about your color, baby, it's going to be just right. And she was, to this day, I stir my condensed milk until it looks to be just about the color of my wrist. But when I went to look at the tomb, I saw the paperwork. I said, wow, there had been quite a few relatives buried there also. But the name on the top said J, initial Vign, V-I-G-N-E. And so I did a little obligatory ancestry DNA check. All we really knew about him was that he had died very young and had been some kind of musician. I'm putting quotation marks around that because that's what I kind of remember. I thought we were told he had been a clarinetist, but no. When I looked up his name, he apparently was one of the earliest trap set drummers. Now, remember in New Orleans parade band type thinking, each drummer was a separate person with one instrument. So he had been a big bass drummer in the bands that marched through the city. And were, you know, we didn't have radio. We didn't have a lot of things, but there were these parades and events where a band would march through. So great-grandfather, John Vign, he changed his name, which was at birth Jean, named after his father, and put a pause on that because we'll be getting right back to that. This is where it got really interesting.
Okay.
But it turns out he was one of the earliest jazz drummers, the drummers who began playing with multiple sets, you know, cymbals, bass, drum, snare. Then I found photos of him, and I said, okay. And then on Ancestry DNA, as I looked, it's clear that he's the father of my grandmother, but his father is a French immigrant who moved here to start his coal and wood business along with a brother, apparently. early in his time here, met a mulatto slave who belonged to someone else.
Now, was he white? Was John white or was
he? Absolutely. Yeah, he was Frenchman, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. you don't want to look at my ancestry DNA because that's the first item on there as a result of Grandpapa. Yeah. But he apparently met a slave woman named Agathe. She was the head cook at the estate of another French New Orleanian at the time because there were a lot of those people who had moved here. The court records show that 14 years after the first encounter, he purchases that woman named Aggie, or Agathe is the way it was said then. We would say Agatha, but she was Agathe with an E at the end. The stipulation in the sale was he could buy her and their two children, because they had already consummated their relationship with two children who were the offspring of the Frenchman and the slave girl. I'm not going to write that novel, but I'll bet I could give it some steamy scenes in that novel I'm not going to write. Anyway, they already had two children. When he purchased her and moved her to the first block of Dauphine Street, Errol, I believe the address at their residence was 31 Dauphine. They have additional children. He gets sick from a fall in 1864, and on his deathbed, in a will that is handwritten and still in the repository of the clerk of civil district court's office, where, in case you never realize it, every notarized document pertaining to everything in the history of New Orleans is right there on Poydras Street. And it's there to find and look at to explore family history. But I digress. So on his deathbed, the Frenchman acknowledges that Agathe is his wife, or the woman who has been his companion for the next 20 years or so after he purchased her, that he names the four children identified as mulatto, and he mentions the baby she's carrying in her womb, and he leaves everything to them. But Louisiana was a state where even if you left something to your black descendants, a white relative could come in and challenge that in court. So fascinating. He dies. His property is placed up for sale in a court-ordered auction.
Who thought we were talking about John, the drummer?
This is the Frenchman who dies.
Okay, okay.
That slave woman appears at the court-ordered auction a month later with cash money, purchases all of his assets from his wood and coal business, and continues to run that business for many years to come. My great-grandfather ultimately grows up in that business, but is also a musician. He is also a shoe repairman, apparently. And according to Danny Barker, because I listened to an interview only this past year and it blew my mind because he's saying, y'all don't know about Ratty John Vane? He was the boss of the drummers. And according to Danny, he also was a successful plasterer because men back then had multiple jobs and they didn't earn a living just playing music. And I say that because I appreciate the fact that in today's New Orleans environment, musicians can actually raise a family and have a good living just playing music. That wasn't an option for my dad, and he always enjoyed seeing younger musicians advance and be able to get fame and fortune without leaving, because that wasn't something that happened a lot back then. You normally had to leave, like a Louis Armstrong or so many others, in order to reach that fame and fortune, because this was not the hotbed of recorded music or the music industry in general.
No.
It's funny, New Orleans was the home of opera because the Creole Opera, which was started by free people of color, was the first opera house. And yet these days we sort of forget all those other glorious aspects of our culture. And I'm trying to wind back to this origin story. People don't always realize, including people of color, that long before the Civil War, New Orleans' population was interesting because about half of the people of color were free people. They were not enslaved. Some of them had slaves. They had property. They were educated. Again, created the opera. Believed in high. They did a lot of the same things that our friends did at the balls for Carnival, Errol. I mean, so much of it was the same because they came from a sort of a Eurocentric Caribbean background. So they also had all of the influence of the Catholic Church because they were under either French or Spanish influence. And, of course, New Orleans was Spanish first. But we never knew any of those things that I started to find out. And I early on said, you know, I need to tell this story not to tell people, oh, gee, Warren Bell found his roots, because there's some things about my grandfather that are scandalous. We might talk about that. But okay. But I wanted it to be a cautionary tale because there are resources all around us, Dr. Laborde, that are there for us to take advantage of to find out who we really are based on who our ancestors really were. Doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs. One of my great-grandfather's, his oldest brother was Leon, who belonged to Economy Hall. He ran the family business with the horse and buggy delivering merchandise. His daughter, Leontine, was the first African-American woman ever hired by New Orleans Public Schools. Turns out she was assigned to the Colored Waifs Home. Sound familiar?
Louis Armstrong.
Louis Armstrong talks about Miss Leontine Vian in some of his recorded interviews. I believe Dave Bartholomew was another who has been a dear friend until the day he passed on, because he and my dad were good friends, and my dad played in his orchestra many, many decades. And another descendant who owned her own corset shop, but here's the best part. Errol, I absolutely remember when Peggy Laborde and I were at WYES 20 years ago talking about her documentary on the French Quarter. And at the time, I shared with her that I knew there had been a strong black presence. But man, it took all these years for me to know that my own family was living right there. Uh-huh. Because when they moved from Dauphin Arrow, they moved over to Bienville, a half block away. Part of the way she made a living after his death, she opened up her own lunch counter on Dauphin, one half block from the house. So she cooked, brought it to her spot at 321 Dauphin. Don't hold me to the actual address, but it's currently a parking lot for the hotel across the street on Dauphin. Mm. So all these things were going on. These were people engaged in commerce, education, etc. And when I say, because he died early and then my grandmother's mother died early. My grandmother grew up basically being raised by aunts and other relatives, but memories didn't last. People didn't tell her a lot about him because the truth is he left his first, I'm using the term wife loosely, because a lot of times people didn't get married. My grandmother was one of nine kids at the very end, but he left that person to be with another person who provided four more sisters for my grandmother. Mm-hmm. And then he left that person to marry someone else and died at the age of 53. So you and I, my friend, have outlived him by 20 years, but I'm not sure he didn't outlive us by some other things, because his clients included all the houses in Storyville. That's where he delivered coal and wood to. His warehouse, interestingly, was in Storyville, but you can hear other musicians' interviews where they talk about learning technique when they'd go and play with the other musicians at Miss Devine's warehouse inside Storyville. Every time I read those things, Errol, it was as if the angels were sending me tidbits to say, tell this story, but let everybody else know, don't let this happen to you folks. And if you are listening to this, whether it's now or in the future, Warren only wanted to tell this story to say the resources are there, and at some point we're all going to be ancestors, not elders. I'm an elder now. Mm-hmm. But I understand we have only vague memories when children remember vaguely what they remember about a grandparent. I know more about my grandmother now than I did when she was right there on St. Ann Street living literally just a few doors away from my mom and dad and us. I think about my father all the time to be a great musician, but to never know that his own grandfather had been a great musician. There are just so many layers to this because we were part of that whole community of people of color. But interestingly, we were not pre-Civil War gens de couleur because she was a slave up until 1864 when he manumitted her. And then they became part of that whole society. But what was fascinating to me, and I wanted that to be part of the story I told, is that sort of forgotten aspect of our history where those free people of color were really quite powerful. They were advocates for equality. They didn't just worry about themselves. They were advocating for voting rights for anybody, and even brought a petition to Abe Lincoln before the Civil War was over, saying, please free those people and give them the right to vote now that you've already occupied New Orleans. So they were very active, but Errol, you're a student of history also. Jim Crow came around, and things that had been were slowly taken away. New Orleans became more of an Americanized city where you didn't see things as black, white, and in between. You saw black or white, and if you were black, that was, you know, Plessy versus Ferguson had a really deleterious effect from an academic standpoint if you look at what happened, because it made it easier for people to say, hey, even you people with wealth and education and stuff are still no different from those people who were slaves. And I think it has a lot to do with some of our persistent problems here. But I don't want to get too philosophical or heavy about that. For me, the real message to all of us, and really is nothing to do with color, is we all have histories. Most of us really should know more, because if you don't know who you came from, how do you fully know who you are? How do you know what is expected of you? If you're African-American and you grew up at an era where you were a little bit embarrassed to even admit that you know that some of your own ancestors were free people of color who owned slaves, you didn't really dig deeply into that at the time. I wish I had, when I had the energy and resources to do so. I still think it was a good story to tell. It was cathartic for me. It's a message digitally encoded now for my grandchildren, because that those kinds of things mean a lot. I know I'll be forgotten. You know what I'm saying? We all get forgotten at one level.
I can be forgotten. They can say Warren Bill at Channel 6 Anchor. No,
you know, and I appreciate that, my friend. But at the end of the day, I want to live on in them. Just as my grandmother and my godmother and my mom, sometimes I'll say things and it's as if my mother had invaded my spirit and made me say something. And maybe I'm making excuses because I have loose lips also, but there are so many things about us that the more we know about those who made us, I think the more we understand who we are as well. And sometimes that's for the good, sometimes that's for the ugly and bad, but it's still best to know than to not know.
How did being Catholic, did it have any effect on that line of your family, of the Creole family?
Both sides, yeah. Yeah. You know, it's, first of all, people think they understand that word Creole, and it's been talked about and intellectualized, et cetera, but it's hard to deny that that Creole population that came in as peoples of color with education and other experiences from their Caribbean habitats, which were very much influenced by the Catholic French and Spanish approaches to government. Interestingly, slaves were treated differently then too. So it's the reason why, circling back to the cemetery angle, St. Louis number one and then 34 years later, St. Louis number two are both referred to as New Orleans historic Creole cemeteries, because they were cemeteries that from day one specified people of color could also be buried there. My tomb, I didn't mention this before, is right there along Claiborne Avenue at St. Louis number two, my family tomb. It's now mine because I made the decision to renovate it and eventually to occupy it, if you know what I'm saying. Sure. Hopefully down the road, but
no,
we all have to know where we're going to go.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I understand people saying I'm going to do this, but you mentioned being a Catholic. I sometimes say I'm still a practicing Catholic despite the sometimes sordid or sad history of Catholicism when it comes to some things that were tolerated. But at the end of the day, I knew I wanted to be at a Catholic cemetery.
Yeah.
Okay? And so here was great-grandfather cemetery. Here's where my grandmother is, other relatives, that some of whom I remember. But Errol, we even have Kaufmans in that tomb, because you see, back then people mingled a lot. And so my own godmother was the result indirectly of a liaison between someone named Kaufman and one of my grandmother's female cousins. And if you saw my godmother, you'd know. Uh-huh. I'll just leave it at that. Very distinctive features. And reminded me of many Jewish women I've known. Again, it's just interesting.
So the Kaufmans were traditionally a Jewish family.
It was
so
a Jewish family. We've always had Jewish friends, family members, etc. It's that incredibly unique thing about New Orleans because of all those different influences and liaisons, let's face it. We have this interesting batch of people with a cultural milieu that is like no other because it's so many different elements in that pot of cultural gumbo we have created here and that we celebrate. Sometimes I worry that we only celebrate certain aspects but are not some of those aspects that I like to celebrate, mm-hmm. like, hey, who brought opera? Who believed in education? Who sent their children to Europe to be educated when they couldn't get a full sure. class education here? These were people who were every bit as much important to the building and making of New Orleans as any others. And the more I looked around that cemetery, the more I realized, my God, they're everywhere. Whether it's Henriette DeLille, soon to be a saint, we hope, from the Sisters of the Holy Family. But
she was the one who founded Xavier, right?
Actually, she founded the St. Mary's Academy. The Sisters of the Holy Family serviced so many different schools and missions around, but there's several hundred of them buried right there. Dominic Yu, the pirate master who saved the Battle of New Orleans because he knew artillery and he kicked the British you-know-whats to the point where General Jackson said, forget about his pirate past, this is our hero.
Yeah.
Mr. Milne, Alexander Milne, was a Scotsman, came to New Orleans to do hardware business, got filthy rich, built a brick foundry at the time when New Orleans was really on the boom, and at the time of his death, turn of the century, Errol, he supposedly was responsible for making 90% of all the bricks used in New Orleans construction. And I would simply say to you, you know the riverfront, et cetera, most of those are his bricks. Uh-huh. But his granite tower stands like it stands tall, 30, maybe 40 feet, solid granite, with his famous bequest that his wealth be used to provide funds to help the orphan children of New Orleans. And so the Milne Center, which was the Milne Boys' Home, is a result of Alexander Milne, again, buried right there, and nobody can see it because the Archdiocese chooses to keep that place shuttered, and only family members can visit inside.
Because it's in bad
shape. Well, one of the things they've said over and over, as I said, how is it this is the only one you're doing this to? They said, well, we have to be concerned about the safety of our patrons because of concerns about vandalism. So, you know, I used to be a newsman once in a while, Errol, and I wound up reaching out to the NOPD, and I have the data. And there are almost no incidents in that vicinity, and the only ones they could report occurred outside the cemetery, so that had no... Also, there was a time when there were, shall we say, dubious developments in the neighborhood. Public housing wasn't always the bright, shiny stuff we see now, but now that place is surrounded by some Hano-subsidized housing that's pretty middle class. There's a high-rise development right behind St. Louis Number 1 that's very much middle class. You can just see all the gentrification people coming in and out. These are people who've moved to New Orleans and are very happy to be right there. And so for me, the question is, couldn't we find a way to capitalize on the interest in that cemetery? Go ahead and let them do tours like they do at Number 1, but whenever I ask, so couldn't you at least dedicate some of the revenue that you're generating because of the incredible popularity of cemetery tours towards the premise of renovating the ones that don't have a family member like me anymore to spend a few thousand to renovate a tomb and then say, I'm going to occupy. But when I tell you that I'll walk through anytime you want, talk to me, we'll see if we can use my family pass. A walkthrough is almost a spiritual experience. Ooh, maybe that's a bad choice of words.
It's a good choice.
But I've said to people, it's not a brag, but when you go there with a camera, the images you get can't help be beautiful because they're haunting. And again, that was a pun intended. But it's as if the souls of all those ancestors are saying, is it fair that we are allowed to deteriorate like this? When I asked how come, I was told, well, you know, family members are responsible for tombs. And then I said, well, what if the family's been gone for 100 years and nobody even knows there's a tomb there that one of their ancestors is in? And about that point is when I was told, you know, we're not going to have any of those interviews on camera with you that we had scheduled. And this is all on email. And Errol, I didn't want to take on the Catholic Church. I am a Catholic here. But it took multiple, how shall I put it, please, even to our good shepherd himself, our archbishop, to say, I am not trying to embarrass you. I'm trying to help us find a way to say, what can we do with this place that is so historically significant? It's on the Louisiana African American Heritage Trail. It's on the National Register of Historic Places because of that whole multicultural, unique history that's all, it's history that's buried right there, thus my title for my series. But I just don't understand how we couldn't say, let's continue to let someone make money operating tours, but let's dedicate a portion of those tours to identifying the most historically significant tombs there, to restore them and celebrate those history makers all around us. It is not a black cemetery. It's not a Creole cemetery. They call it Creole because they allowed Creoles in, but everybody was buried there. Mm-hmm. And it's just a shame that we drive by along the interstate, and if you, as long as you're paying attention, look over to your right as you're heading east on the I-10. Look at those three square blocks of incredible architectural examples that are being allowed to deteriorate. I have been shooting some footage of one of my former St. Augustine High School classmates who is their official plasterer. They're repairing one of those huge society tombs right now because things got so bad it was becoming dangerous and a section literally fell off. So we know what to do to restore. It isn't cheap, but I think if the world knew what was in there and saw what was in there and understood that it's just like every other Catholic cemetery, except you can walk in those without an appointment. Number one does require a paid ticket. And I don't even have a problem with one person having that exclusive franchise. However, why can't we reinvest in the thing that people are paying anyway to see? And I don't want to, I don't want to dwell too much on that because I still think it's a beautiful place. I'm very happy that I was able to complete what I used to call my legacy project, Errol, except now my dear friend David Jones and I are talking about whatever the next project will be. And let me say this, because you know David Jones very well. David Jones is probably one of the most talented, prolific directors and video editors I have ever known, bar none. And he certainly has done a lot of work with Miss Peggy Laborde on multiple documentaries. And I always tell people, I know what I want, but David renders it into what I thought was the vision, and then it's so much better than what I could have rendered without his sensitivity to the issues. It was as if it was his own family story he was telling, because we didn't have a big budget. What I had to work with was the kind of money that normally someone should pay him just for his part, but it was my story. I had to tell it. I couldn't think of any partner who could help me tell it and could help me create the effect of not just telling a personal story, but also using my journey to show people different steps and resources that I took advantage of. And they're there and they're free. So you can find out a lot before you have to hire a genealogist. Okay. Let me just say that. And then the public resources.
I want to ask you about restoring the tomb. But first, I want to mention, you've made reference to how beautiful they have looked. This is why I urge everybody to look at that documentary, WYS.org. It's beautiful. There's a lot of old vintage shots of New Orleans at that time and shots from the
cemetery.
That's
David, buddy.
Okay.
That's David.
You can watch it once and listen to Warren. Watch it again, put on the mute, and just look at the pictures, because it's really beautiful.
The problem is I wrote so much into each sentence that listen to Warren just to get what you missed the first time. Yeah. But I'm teasing, of course. Yeah. But I appreciate your saying that. You know, Errol, I've laughed for several years whenever my daughters wanted to hire a photographer for their children's portraits and stuff and said, you know, I have a camera, blah, blah, blah. And they'd look at me, as daughters do, and say, you're not a professional photographer. Well, in this case, we were trying to stretch our dollars. And so I started going out there sort of as a lark, with my Sony 4K camera, yeah, which shoots video very well, apparently, because yeah, 95% of all the images you saw other than the interviews, which I couldn't shoot because I was in those, and the drone shots, I shot those as either still pictures or as video clips. And the more I did it, the more I got into it. But let me say this also. I don't want to discredit David. Throughout my life, Errol, I worked with some really talented news photographers right here in New Orleans, from the Ronald Montelepres to the Lloyd Edwards to the, oh, my God, the names, Jim Bumgardner, Floyd Ignelli, all those names I used to say, with cameraman, blah, blah, blah. This is Warren. But you remember what they always did. I wasn't trying to be an MTV videographer moving around with the camera. No, 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 no. So I remembered things David always said about the way to get shots that you can work with. But it was really gratifying also to be the person who shot most of the footage. The scenes are haunting, like I said. I think anyone with a good camera could probably get 80 or 90%. I know a little something about cropping and creating a certain kind of a feel. My proudest shot is the one where you see the shadow of a cross but being reflected on another tomb. And I said, oh, you used that. You saw that, did you, David? He said, it was what it was supposed to be. So I want people to see what they're missing when they drive around. But here's a little tip. One backside of square number two in the middle is only steel fencing. And anybody with a camera could slip it right through the fence so you don't see the bars and actually get some pretty scenes, because I posted some on Facebook just the other day.
Okay.
When I was outside.
Right. Marie Laveau is in St. Louis, number one.
Number
right?
one, yes, sir.
Yeah.
Well, yes, and then there are those who say she was actually moved to St. Louis, number two, and there's actually one wall vault where people say she might be, and you can tell that's what they believe because you see the scratchings and the little teeny offerings that are left there. I have no clue as to how much veracity there is to that, but when you see the tourists at number one, the tour guides usually bring them to a spot that's, interestingly, Errol, right next to where Dutch Morial was laid to rest way back in 1989. Another little tidbit, Dutch Morial was eventually moved over to Esplanade Avenue to St. Louis number three, because I understand the family was a little concerned that there was so much tourist activity at the tomb next door for Marie Laveau, they thought it was inappropriate.
And Dutch's wife, Sybil, did not like to use the word Creole.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. You know, she's the one who taught me how to say the name Agath.
Oh, really?
So, it's funny. It's a sensitive subject. There was a time when there were Creoles, how shall I put it, who insisted that only that the only Creoles were white Creoles and the others were somehow... Well, I won't even try to explain it. Most scholarship these days says, yes, of course, there were people of color, too, because the name was sort of derived from anyone who had come through that passage via the Caribbean, et cetera. I know and have studied and learned even more lately, but Creoles always came in every color, including dark chocolate, but they still spoke fluent French. They still believed in accomplishment, education, culture, et cetera, et cetera. And that was one of the reasons I featured one of the ladies in my piece, because I didn't want to just talk about Warren discovering his connection. Mark Rudinet lived white his entire adult life. His father and mother were very anti-black, so they left New Orleans when he was a kid, and they moved up north. At age 50-something, Mark opens up some boxes his father never allowed him to see when he was still alive, but when his father died, he opens up a box that isn't marked on the outside, and he finds a collection of newspapers from New Orleans called Le Union, which was a weekly published by blacks, and then the New Orleans Tribune, the original Tribune, and then he finds out that the publisher of that paper has his same name. And so Dr. Louis-Charles Rudinet, who was one of those free people, well-educated, et cetera, was the man who went to France, finished med school, came back in that climate in the 1840s, and started his own paper to advocate for the rights of people of color. And it's called the New Orleans Tribune. Mark Rudinet was in his 50s, and we wanted to use the soundbite where he talks about that revelation hitting him like a ton of bricks. And Errol, you know these stories from me already, but on both sides of my family, there were members who left, and you know the term passablanc, but this was very real. On both my mother's side and my father's side, my father's father, whom I never met, moved from New Orleans after my father was 1 year old, married another Creole woman, high yellow, as we say, and they lived and died in Los Angeles, California, raising a family that never, ever knew that they were my cousins. My father never knew he had a sister. And I get a little emotional because it's very sad in a lot of ways. And I can remember my mother on my other side of my family saying, the two brothers I'll never, ever see. I haven't seen them since they were, since I was a little girl, because they were older. My mother was one of 14, Errol. Two of her brothers left and never returned to the black community. They lived and raised their children as white. And you may remember, I've told this story around YES a lot. At one point, I met someone with the same last name as my mother and said, help me out. Where are you from? And she told me, and I said, so are you married to a Ricard? Or? And then she said, well, I'm married to one. And I said, are y'all in Chalmette? And Errol, this was my uncle's son's wife I was on the phone with. And she was speechless. And then she said, I need to get back to you. And that was the first time I met my cousins. We always knew about them on our side, but they never knew where their own first cousins were, mm-hmm. across the tracks in Chalmette from us. Mm-hmm. So to me, there's so many tragedies in our story. Our story in New Orleans is so beautiful in so many ways, and yet it's like a Shakespearean tragedy or a Greek tragicomedy. I mean, there's joie de vivre, there's things to celebrate, but imagine what we might be had we gotten along better at some point. I don't know. I hate to sound like a silly, blithering old man, but I really regret some of the sort of retrogression I've seen. I worry about what we celebrate as our culture without remembering other aspects of it. Sure. You know, speaking as a black man in New Orleans, I'm very proud of the things we celebrate as our culture, but our culture is a lot more than beads and feathers. It's a lot more than second line parades. And I get in trouble, I think, when people hear me say that. I'm not throwing shade, but on the other hand, why don't we celebrate the fact that we used to be a community that elected a black mayor, that demanded justice, that stood for certain things? And I'm not sure we even worry about that as much. Look at the voter turnouts lately. Look how easy it was for someone who was certainly not a moderate or even liberal Republican is now our governor and sending a storm, I mean, state troopers, et cetera. But to me, that is more evidence of New Orleans spending more time partying than progressing, if you know what I'm saying. In January, it's okay to plan for Carnival, but let's plan for how we're going to get ahead so that a year from now we'll be here instead of where we are. But I know that's a very sensitive subject. I still do a little bit of carnival myself, and I go to a couple of balls, let me confess. But I've sometimes wondered if, and I've said this to you already off the mic, have we gotten to the point where there's so many parades now that we don't appreciate the good ones? Because now everybody wants to throw a parade and be part of it. And I've done that, Errol. I've been up there with beads and stuff to be a rider one time. And it was exhausting, and I was with a pretty good crew, Harry Connick's crew, right? Orpheus.
It had nothing to do with race, but politics. Councils can't say no. So if somebody says, you know.
I know, man. It's true.
Yeah. Look at Jefferson Parish. I knew what you were thinking about
because that's a perfect example. You say yes to everyone, and then a year later they're saying, oh, well, sorry. We took a lot of folks' money and stuff, but we can't make this happen.
Yeah, we don't have money.
Or the float builders are owed $100,000. It's heartbreaking. Yeah.
Let me ask you just about the time we have left, about the process of restoring the tomb.
Yes, sir.
Okay, when you started, most of the tombs in there were kind of run down, but your family wasn't as bad as the others.
We had cracks. There was some vegetation coming out of some cracks in the back and the front, and we do show the before pictures. But to do it right, you've got to have a team come in to I forget what that tool is called, but it knocks away all of the original plaster. So what you see is what all of them look like beyond that normally, and that's the brick structure that creates the tomb shape. Normally, mine is one on top of one. Some have two and two. But that is then, in order to, first it had to be stripped, then fresh plaster applied after any repairs that were needed were made. I didn't have any bricks falling or any of that stuff. So it wasn't cheap, but it was still a heck of a lot cheaper than, say, finding a mausoleum space, if you can find one these days. Because here's another aspect. The city is kind of in a quandary trying to figure out how to convince citizens that New Orleans has to address the need for a fresh cemetery. We don't have any room in our municipal cemeteries any more than Catholic Charities, and what they've got is premium priced when it's a private cemetery. Mausoleum prices, $14,000 to $20,000, and for $20,000, I think you get to bury two people and then later two more, and then they tell you that's it. A tomb at St. Louis Cemetery is literally evergreen because you can continue to put someone as long as it's been a year and a day later.
So there's three St. Louis cemeteries.
There is St. Louis one, which is the original, created under Spanish rule. 34 years later, we were back. We had our first New Orleans council. We were under American rule. That's when they opened the second one. They were a little nervous because they realized, oops, this is so close to the first. And already New Orleans was growing beyond Rampart Street, Errol. You know that. So number one had been assigned anyway to the church elders. The council became worried that they didn't want to build a municipal site where number two is. So they handed that to the Catholic Church so they could move further away to build whatever was going to be their next cemetery. The name escapes me. All of our cemeteries have amazing history, let me say that. Mm-hmm. I've walked through many others since St. Louis number two to take photos, video clips, and no matter where you are, it's amazing. Now, it's great. You can go spend your time amongst the spirits of the millionaires at Metairie Cemetery, and it's an amazing journey, but I'm just as content walking over the cracks in the concrete with the weeds and just reading names and seeing messages. There's one tomb in there that was built for a woman who died very young, and her husband apparently loved her and grieved for her until he joined her there. There's a shot in my piece where you see this statue looking up to heaven with the blue sky. That's her, and I forget her name. I'm sorry. I used to be able to throw her name out too. But it's another example of how we bury and memorialize our loved ones. And I wonder if any of that couple's descendants even know right where they are, because nobody
cares.
Have
you ever explored St. Rock Cemetery?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
I have peoples buried there, too.
My
mother-in-law was placed there just a few months ago.
That's kind of a classic old cemetery, and they have the little cemetery there where people leave devotions.
Absolutely. Well, you have the chapel at St. Rock 1 and another chapel at St. Rock 2, and the restoration of one of those was like a world-class undertaking. And again, my buddy Jeff Poirier and others were all involved in that because there aren't that many master-class plaster masons anymore. That's a dying art. And unfortunately, we have so many New Orleans buildings that still depend on that art. So the people who know how to do it can command a pretty price, but they're all telling me we can't find any more to replace us. It's sad.
Yeah. So you're... family tomb, it's complete. It's ready now.
We are working on what they call the cover tablet, the slab, which will someday, I guess, acknowledge my great-grandfather, but there's got to be space for Warren A. Bell Jr.
Yeah.
And I've thought about going ahead and doing it, Errol, and having 1951 with a hyphen and a space to be filled in later. I hope later, but it is what it is. And I did want to do this so that even if it's tomorrow for me, this message lives on, I think. I have a feeling YES is going to play it more because it is an enduring message. Don't let your elders become your ancestors, because then they can't say anything to help you know who you are.
And I know the message you want to bring is that there are resources.
Yes, sir. Public library. The clerk of court's office has 300-plus years worth of notarized documents. every notary, when he closes his books, has to turn them over to the criminal district, civil district court. Notarial archives is on its own floor. It is built to withstand hurricanes. And in Katrina, when all that stuff was flying off the Hyatt, it was slamming into their windows and nothing got touched inside. I've been there and seen the marks where beams and stuff were flying by. It didn't break that glass, and it didn't penetrate that vault.
Okay. Well, let me ask you one last thing on a different topic here. Because,
sure.
As we started this recording, we're sitting around. On the day that we recorded this, Edgar Chase, who's the son of who's the son of Dookie Chase, died. Dookie Chase has always been a mysterious person. I mean, I've asked people, including Edgar, about Dookie, and it's like,
I don't know,
he kind of lived in his own world.
Yeah.
Okay. But you surprised me. You said you knew him. So just tell me something briefly about Dookie Chase.
Well, Mr. Chase, who was Leah Chase's husband, Edgar Jr., he and my father started Craig Elementary School together in kindergarten. Around second or third grade, I forget what the name was, but it was a legendary early band leader there. You know, public school band leaders are the secret to all of New Orleans musical heights. They all taught these young men early, and since then, young men and women. But so Daddy and Dookie were good friends. Dookie, as a teenager, was into the music. Daddy was into his saxophone. So there's a classic portrait of the Dookie Chase Orchestra around 1948, and there's Mr. Chase with his trumpet. He was the band leader. And Errol, if you didn't look really closely, you'd think that was Ricky Ricardo. Yeah. Mr. Dookie looked a lot. I mean, he was another handsome New Orleans man from the Treme. And so was my dad. So they were kind of buddies. My mom remembers when she moved here or when she met my dad. She had moved from the country when she was 5 or 6. But she met my dad when she saw him on a band stage. He was playing a solo. And so she said, I'm going to marry that man. Turns out when my dad brought my mom to meet Dookie, to introduce his wife to Dookie and his new wife, Leah Chase, who had moved from the country to marry Dookie, was the most welcoming of the ladies she remembered from that whole New Orleans Creole genteel society, because my mother wasn't that at all. She came straight from the country, off a farm. Free people of color background, but still poor people who had come here. And so for all their lives, they remained friends. And then when my father died, it was Mr. Chase who had already throughout the years said, you know, I know you, and we would always share stories. But after my dad died, whenever we'd see each other, we'd get tearful about all of our memories. So he died 10 years after my dad. When we had our very last celebration for my mom, and my mom knew she was going, and she said, let's do a repast before. Let's call it a prepast. So we rented the whole place, Chase, Dookie Chase Restaurant. And Edgar and Stella, and this is your friend Edgar, my classmate, not classmate, but we were contemporaries, because we were the two sons of Warren Bell and Dookie Chase. Uh-huh. And we were, he was the third, I was junior. They really took care of us, honored my mother, talked about the lifelong connection between the family. Edgar was a Jesuit, I was at St. Augs, so we didn't know each other well until we became adults. But years later at Dillard University, when I joined their humanities faculty, Edgar was already there teaching business classes, went on to be the business chair. He was a genteel, class act, always a smile, always a warm personality, not in your face like some big personality types. Oops, yeah. Did I say that? But just a quiet kind of confidence and command. And I'm really sorry. I sent messages personally. I knew he was sick because his sister had told me, pray for Duke the third because he's had a heart attack. And so now we have to say goodbye to another member of that amazing family. Let me say this, though, Errol, if you've been there, the rest of the family really has a good thing going on. I'm so happy to see the Chase family legacy perpetuated in this second and these next generations.
Well, he has a son named Duke.
Duke the fourth. Yeah, yeah. Duke Ivy, but that's Duke IV.
Yeah.
And I reached out to him as well. And a lot of the other children are in that kitchen right now fixing the food, which, in fact, you'll see that on my documentary also, okay. Ladies and gentlemen.
Warren, thank you. What's next? What's your next project?
We're talking about something that actually is semi-related. You know, the history of Storyville has never totally been told. We think we know things. But for me, it's a story of some amazing women who found their, you know, there's that phrase now, women finding their worth or finding their value. Well, what do you say about madams who found their value and became the equivalent these days of multimillionaires, building their own three-story houses and running their business, which was legal at the time, remember? But black and white. Fascinating stories. Yeah. Some of the mansions they lived in, we can still see one on Grand Rue St. John. Josie's place. Josie's buried at Metairie Cemetery. Then her family sells the tomb, which was something of wonder. So there's a lot out there. But there's other, people forget. You know, we all celebrate the baby dolls. Well, we sort of fudge on what the true history is. The baby dolls were working girls in Storyville who decided on Carnival Day they were going to have some fun and sort of show the customers what they were missing if they didn't visit their houses. And that was their way of marketing their wares, W-A-R-E-S. But sometimes you hear these sort of euphemized, euphemistic definitions of what they were. No, they were working girls.
Yeah.
Okay, and God bless them. they knew their value and they worked it.
Sure.
But it was, sometimes you hear these different, very intellectual explanations. But again, that's something we really have our eye on.
A lot of people want to change history as you go along.
Well, it's part of it's catering to tourists or what we think certain people want to hear now. So suddenly it's as if the baby dolls were freedom fighters, Errol. Yeah. I mean, come on, y'all. Give me a break. Okay. I've seen photos of what the Mardi Gras Indians used to dress like. And guess what? It wasn't all those plumes and feathers. No. So things sort of evolve, but not always with the purity of what they came from. Yeah. And I'll just leave it at that because I know I'm going to get in trouble with some of the culture entrepreneurs. Well, thank you so much.
You got a good thing going, and you have a good background. You have a good history. You have good stories that need to be told. So damn it, tell them, you know.
I'm going to try, brother. You know, I sort of moped around after retirement and said, oh, gee, woe is me. And I had a buddy who worked with me years ago saying, how is it you were one of the most talented people? He didn't say one of, but he said you were so talented, and yet you stayed here after you left Channel 8. And I said, look, I had other TV in my blood still, and I did Channel 12 after that, et cetera. But for me, it was a choice of children and a house I had bought 30 years ago at the time, and I didn't want to drag my kids all over to chase my vanity or my vain quest to be on the air again. And you know what's kind of comforting? I'm on the air again, Errol. It's more news to come. I'm getting roses I didn't ever expect or thought I deserved, but stay tuned. I got other stuff coming. It's been interesting. God bless me.
We will stay tuned. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life Magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.